He came up to Bell Labs once when I had been up there for several years, and he came up and filmed me to show him some of the work in chemistry, and he almost exploded. He said, but you people got your head in the clouds up here. You're doing all this basic research. You're not working on products. So I thought, the university professor coming and accusing us of being too basic in our research, and he, why aren't we doing something that's immediately apparent as a useful activity? But
were you aware when you started the work on the gaseous diffusion, were you aware of the ultimate goal of the Manhattan Project?
Well, graduate students talk among each other and compare notes and so forth, and they were very careful. They never talked about Los Alamos, and they never talked about Oak Ridge and so forth. There was location X and there was location Y and so forth. And but professors had dropped little hints and so forth. And so we put our heads together, and you know, we had a pretty good idea of what it was, but I think we were as surprised as anyone when it actually came to pass. And I guess it was Hiroshima that brought it to our attention, just like everybody else. But so we had a pretty good inkling about it, but we didn't have any information whatsoever about what was being done at other places except the ones that I mentioned. You know, I didn't know that Oak Ridge and Los Alamos were involved. I didn't know anything about these places. I didn't know that there was a project in Hanford, because there were different things that were being pursued. We had the gaseous diffusion project, but then there was I think it was a Y-12 project or something. Mm-hmm. That was essentially an electromagnetic separation using a spectrometer, if you'd like, that was separating out the isotopes, and nobody knew how to. Now here we were working on trying to make these miles and miles and miles of tubing that would do it. All of them were pretty fanciful at that time, and at least those two that I mentioned ended up as being part of the final process. So I really wasn't completely aware of it, but neither were we completely ignorant of what was going on. But they certainly had a tight security. They were not mentioning lightly what we were going to do.
Were you cautioned about not saying anything to anybody about what you were doing?
Probably in a mild way. You know, I was certainly said it was a secret project, shouldn't be talked about, but they gave us so little information, we really didn't know much of anything except what we were really working on. Mm-hmm. So I guess the caution was heard and observed. After all, we were aware of the fact that there was a war on. I had two brothers who were getting shot at, and I would say that the attitude of the graduate students that I saw and the people on it was one of total cooperation with the whole thing. There wasn't any looseness in the way they approached the security. There wasn't any attempt on anybody's part to say, is this thing what society needs or anything. And we were in a war. And when we finished, the project was successful. I think all of us were very proud of having been part of it. And I am today proud of it. And the people who think it was wicked to have done that, well, they didn't know about how many 100,000 people would have gotten killed going into Japan. Mm-hmm. So I just disagree with the protesters completely. It's misguided.
That's just this recent business with the Enola Gay exhibit, the Smithsonian, is a, mm-hmm. that's a good example of that.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, and there was some of that that was going on at the time, but not at our low level, because after all, you know, Oppenheimer and other people had great willingness to pass information to the Russians. I don't have heard of anybody passing it to the Nazis, but they were certainly sympathetic to the Russian. Mm-hmm. And of course, it ended up that almost immediately after the end of the war, we found out where we stood with them. In fact, my boss at Bell Labs, and I wouldn't put this in any account, but he said when the end of the war came, he was working on that project too. In fact, he was the one who conceived the nature of the metallurgical process that produced this successful barrier. And when the Hiroshima bomb had been dropped in Nagasaki, and then the end of the war came, he said, if we had any sense now, and it'll never come to pass because the country wouldn't do it, what we should do is to go around and drop one on the Russians right now, and we'd save a lot of trouble later on. He was saying that in to startle us and to be humorous, but I often thought afterwards, you know, that we, at that time, for a brief period, we had it and they didn't. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Did you initiate the contact with Bell Labs?
No, Charlie Smyth did.
Oh, okay.
Charlie Smyth and Sal, well, where are you going to go to work? And I said, I want to go to the industrial laboratory. And there were only, this was during the war, and a lot of them were not really doing research. I thought I wanted to do research, real research. And we talked it over and came up with a list of three places that I was interested in. And one was DuPont, and one was Shell Development in Emeryville. Because there had been some exceedingly good work done by some people I knew about out there, catalysis and so forth. And the third one was Bell Labs. And I knew less about them. Well, when interviews, so it was really Charlie who got me straightened out on this, and I was interviewed at all three. But the one at Shell gave this show away because one of the people that I saw during the course of the day said, you know, none of us are doing research here. We're just all working on engineering projects because of the war. See, that was during the war, still was on. So washed out the Shell right away, and I went down to DuPont and visited two or three of their divisions. And they probably didn't want to make me an offer anyway. It didn't lead anywhere, but I went up to Bell Labs where Burns, was chemical director, and he had gone through chemistry, got his PhD at Princeton. So this was the Princeton crowd at work. I went up there and I instantly knew this is the place I want to be. And they offered me a job, and I said to Burns, I'm very interested, but I said, is this a permanent job? Well, they're really only hiring people on a temporary basis to the end of the war. I said, I'm not interested. I don't want it. It's a permanent job or nothing. So we talked about that some more, and finally they offered me a job on a permanent basis. And I think that there were only three of us hired at Bell Labs as chemists during the war on that basis. The rest were laid off at the end of the war, you know, they said, okay, you've been in World War. But I didn't want to be... I've had a greater desire for security in my employment than that. So even though I was working in the Manhattan Project, and that came to an end at the end of the war, then I went to work on Bell Labs' work after that. And the other two also stayed, but most of the people that got hired during the war left at the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was 44, so you were there at least a year working on the Manhattan Project when the war ended in 45.
Yeah, it was about a year, I guess.
Did you sense anything of the, to use a more pop, I guess a popular term, the culture of Bell Labs at that time, or was it overshadowed by the war effort?
No, I learned something of it, and so I certainly a lot more than I knew about it when I applied for a job there and got hired. And I discovered that there are all kinds of people around who, if, when you meet them, you didn't think, well, this guy. And then you discovered how bright they were, and you found out those are some of the brightest people you'll ever meet. But they were all very modest and unassuming, and so I don't mean they all were, but you didn't get the impression of the intellectual power that was around the halls there until after you'd been there a while, and then you began to realize that you came in thinking you were pretty smart because you'd just gotten a fresh PhD from prestigious university, and so these people are obviously going to be impressed with you. But they'd come around and ask what you did, and then they'd ask me some questions about what did I think about this or that. I'd say, gee, I can't even think about that subject. That's way beyond me. So I, yes, I learned. Well, one of the things I learned was that something that reinforced in later years that Bell Labs was probably, and I think this is an honest and fair statement, the most widely admired industrial research laboratory in the world. And that doesn't mean it was necessarily chemistry was its specialty, but it was a model for a lot of other companies that used to be a path to our door trying to find out what's the secret of your success. So I don't mean to imply that I knew all that when I was just being interviewed.
When the war ended, how quickly did things change?
Well, we got off the Manhattan Project pretty darn fast because, and got on to Bell Labs work, and nothing changed. So, I mean, people were leaving war work and getting back to telephone company work, and what took over then was the traditional Bell Labs approach to things. Things had been pretty well dictated by the needs of the war work during those years, but then it came back to being things that would help the telephone company, and Bell Labs had a very long-term view of that as to what was going to help the telephone company. I mean, their tradition was to do things which had a long-range potential for helping the telephone company. They weren't pushing you to get a result this year or make a progress report every Friday afternoon, nothing of the sort. And as the system became clearer to me over the years, and as I helped to, as I became an administrator of things, it was a good place to go, and you had all kinds of freedom, but one of the freedoms was to hang yourself, in effect. They'd support you in all kinds of ways, but if you didn't see whether you could use those freedoms and so forth and that support, and if you couldn't, it was sort of, well, it's been nice knowing you. So we quietly separated plenty of people. But, so you either, it was like teaching a bunch of children to swim by throwing a ball into the water. They'll either swim or they won't swim. And the ones who can't, I don't mean we let them drown in this, but at the Bell Labs, if they couldn't make it in that kind of environment, well, they had to have the initiative and ability to produce in a competitive environment, but very cooperative environment. It's competitive in the sense that we wanted to be the best and to do well. It was a great place to be. I was extremely lucky. A lot of our people said they would have been happy to work there for nothing if they had didn't have to eat, because it was so much fun. Great place.
What did Ray Bondi at Dow Chemical told me that he described the same thing in the 30s at Dow, but what he called it was accountable freedom, the term he used. And you're essentially saying the same
thing.
Yeah,
I think that's right. I didn't know him. I met him, but it was there was freedom, and they were tolerant about it. But you eventually, something had to come to pass. I mean, it didn't go on for 5 or 10 years. In fact, that later on, I really discovered and helped create a kind of a attitude on this. If somebody wasn't doing something that looked really worthwhile in 3 or 4 years after he came, he's better able to get another job when he can still coast on his professor's recommendations. If he spent 8 years with us and then the other potential employer said, what he did, well, he failed, and so you know, we didn't want to be in that position, so we'd help him find another spot. But so we had very high standards in what they'd have to do, but we give them an awful lot of freedom. As I say, almost the freedom to hang themselves, if that's what came most easily to them.
Manhattan Project stops. You go to looking at mechanisms of thermionic emission from the oxide cathodes.
The oxide cathode is the electron emitter in an electron tube, vacuum tube, as they were often called. And a man named Vainelt, obviously a German, had discovered in 1904, I may have missed it by a year, that the best coating for a thermionic emitter in one of those things was a mixture of alkaline earth oxides, notably barium, always some strontium, and occasionally sometimes some calcium in there. And now, here we were in 1945, 46, 47. We presumably a whole lot smarter than we'd been back in the, you know, the vacuum tube had been hardly invented at the time that he discovered that. We couldn't believe that the very best thermionic emitter had been discovered in the really primitive days of the vacuum tube. Well, as it turns out, it had been. But I went to work to try to... Semiconductors were a hot new idea in physics. The Germans had, and Fred Seitz had talked about some of the defects in solids and so forth. That's a new concept for us me and so forth, and we learned about semiconductors and holes and electrons and so forth, but it was in a primitive state because they weren't the semiconductors were compounds, like 2,6 compounds, and nobody was quite sure of them. They didn't even know about NP type semiconductors. Well, so I set out to try to, but we had an idea, and it was really implanted in me by my boss, but it fell out of discussions that he and a theoretical physicist had who gave us some help and so forth. And we worked out a program trying to find out whether these oxide cathodes weren't semiconductors, because you could have explained things about their thermionic emission, not just from the low work function, the energy level difference to get an electron out of the interior of the solid and so forth. So I set out to do that, but these are powders, and boy, it was a messy business, and I was flailing away at this, making some progress and publishing a couple of papers and so forth, but it was kind of depressing at how you couldn't make single crystals or anything of the material. And I and a few other people around the world, some people in Holland, Bob Sproul was up at Cornell working on it, and a few others. The thing that the salvation came when some of our colleagues at Bell Labs invented the transistor, because at that point nobody was going to care anymore about the oxide cathode. We couldn't care less, and so the bandwagon was, and that was in germanium, and it was a great relief, because at that point it made my work obsolete. So I didn't have to continue. It had been moderately successful, but I'd have hated to spend my life trying to work on oxide cathodes. God, what a mess. Trying to measure things like Hall effect and so forth and to learn the properties of the carriers. You know? No single crystals. Do you know Bob Sproul? Or
who I know, yes, yes.
Well, he was a graduate student of Cornell at that time, and he made the first single crystals of barium oxide, and maybe it was a solid solution of barium and strontium oxide. And he got some measurements made, but it was hard work for all of us. And so what happened then was that the first transistor was germanium, and it was not a single crystal, because the great genius had put together a group at Bell Labs of physicists at the end of the war for the, really, he knew that they wanted a transistor, but all they knew were there were strange electronic effects in classes of compounds, including the silicon, which had been, which not a compound, but it was a polycrystalline material that had been used as a detector in for radar in World War II. And he wanted to explore those, and I think he had in mind that it might have an amplifier. And if you think about it, I mean, here's the telephone company. We had 1 million employees within a few years, and we had a network all over the whole country, and it all depended upon electrical signals being amplified and so forth. And you're going to do all that with vacuum tubes. That's doing it the hard way. And if you could get a solid state amplifier, it would revolutionize communications and all of electronics. And so he put this group together in the end of the war, 1945, December of 1947, they made the first transistor. And I think it's arguably the greatest invention of the 20th century. Because everything that you now think of in the way of electronics, and all of that is derived from the invention of the transistor. Without the transistor, none of it would have happened. The whole computer revolution, and all the other electronic things that are changing life today, communication and so forth. So they invented it, but Shockley, Bill Shockley, who is a controversial person, but a real genius. He's a theoretical physicist. He had some odd ideas about race, which got him into hot water after he went out to Stanford to be a professor. But Shockley didn't think it was necessary to have single crystals. They could do everything they wanted with polycrystalline germanium. So the genius who had put this group to work inventing the transistor didn't see how important it would be to have single crystals. And two or three chemists at Bell Labs, and under Bob Burns' aegis, went to work to make the first single crystals of germanium. And then it proved to be such a great thing when they finally did. Gordon Teal, who ended up going to Texas Instruments, made the first one. It was in the laboratory across the hall from me, Bell Labs. And they made these single crystals, and then everybody knew as semiconductors began to develop. Shockley worked out the whole business of PN junctions, N-type, P-type, semiconductors, the doping, all of this. And that's all chemistry. It's chemistry to do it. The transistor itself and the qualities of a PN junction were physics. But making this stuff, you had to have high purity material, you had to have single crystals, it had to be free of defects, free of all kinds of very small quantities of things that would kill the electronic action. And that was a job for chemists. So just there were more people who were chemists working on semiconductors all through the years than physicists, although the idea of the transistor had come from physics. And but everybody could see that silicon was going to be better than germanium, and that's because what's called the energy gap between the electronic band that's filled with electrons and the empty one up behind, and you want to promote a few. That was a bigger gap, so silicon was going to move it be usable at a higher temperature than germanium. Germanium is just barely usable at if the thing warmed up. And furthermore, the mobility that we in silicon was very high. That is, the electrons and holes move very rapidly in a field. So silicon was obviously the material we wanted, but it was very difficult to handle. And nobody could make single crystals, they couldn't make a transistor. So I went to work and as a masquerading as an analytical chemist and designed a mass spectrograph to analyze solids. It ended up later as a commercial instrument that was sold to people for various things, but I worked at that for a couple of years and published that, and in one of the your books, the young lady who had solicited a photograph from
me, yes.
She had, there was a picture of it in,
yes.
In there, the one that, well, it came, that certainly didn't solve all the problems, but it gave some useful information. And then they asked me, there were people working around Bell Labs in research on silicon trying to do this or that, probably a dozen or two. All the big effort was on germanium still. And powers that be asked me to coordinate the research on silicon. That was a concept that hadn't quite occurred to me before, which was to do some work of my own, but to go around and try to goad people into doing work that would reinforce the work of the others. And I had a small group of people, very talented, two or three fellows who were going to try to grow single crystals. That work had been started by Gordon Teal. You remember I told you he'd done the germanium work, and then Gordon Teal, going to greater opportunity as he saw it, meaning more importance than financial things. Gordon was a good friend of mine. He went to Texas Instruments because they wanted to lure somebody who knew this way to TI. And so I was coordinating the silicon work at that point. And I had this group of crystal growers. We were trying to grow single crystals of silicon.